Thank you to the businesses who help support WPR programs, including Farley's House of Pianos, Community Pharmacy, and Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. Play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollop, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollop, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. On May 29, 1984, in a driving rainstorm, Portage County Sheriff Dan Hintz walked by himself into the Tigerton Dells compound of the Posse Comitatus, a paramilitary group described by the FBI as a domestic terrorist, white supremacist organization. Surrounded by heavily armed men, Dan Hintz delivered an ultimatum. They had to leave their compound because it violated local building and zoning ordinances. The group's military leader, Don Minaszewski, slammed a Colt 45 pistol on the table and told Hintz, quote, "You'll walk knee-deep in blood if you try to remove us from the property." But Hintz did remove them and coordinated the effort that closed down the makeshift military camp without a shot being fired. That story is one of many in Dan Hintz's new book, In Pursuit of Justice, Memoirs of a Small Town Sheriff, published by Flash Forward Books and the Working Hour Media Group. I'm Glenn Mobert. For the next hour, we'll talk to Dan Hintz about the Posse Comitatus and about the other stories in that book, the Iola Rock Festival that was a weird mixture of Woodstock and Altamont, the alcohol and drug-fueled crime and accident scenes that became a routine part of his life, and the values he learned growing up in tiny shanty town that he took with him to the big city of Milwaukee and then back to central Wisconsin. We'll talk about the sometimes strained relationship between the police and the public. Sheriff Dan Hintz is also here to answer your questions at 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Dan, thanks for joining us from sunny Florida, where you now live.
Good morning, Glenn. I'm happy to participate. I appreciate the airtime you're giving us to have us share a story.
Now, Dan, a lot of people serve as small-town sheriffs. What made you decide to write a book?
It all started with a small idea. I wanted to leave some legacy for the children and grandchildren and generations to come in my family inspire them to remember where their roots came from, where their parents came from, their grandparents and such. And, it continued to swell. I decided to make it a full book and to mention the people in Portage County, the people that were so dear to me.
Tell us about the guy who helped you with the book, John Spiller.
Yeah, John Spiller is my co-author, a very brilliant man. I met him after selling him a home here in Florida, and we conspired together to write the book. It took just over 2 years. I initially wrote it in longhand. I wrote over 2,000 pages, if you can imagine. And, it was John's expertise that allowed us to reduce that to 300 or less pages, and we made the book a little bit larger so it's easier to handle. And it entails like 264 pages.
And the book, again, is called In Pursuit of Justice, Memoirs of a Small Town Sheriff. And you can get that book on Amazon.com and also another website, bit.ly.com. That's B-I-T-L-Y, bit.ly.com/In Pursuit of Justice, all one word. And Dan, we understand you'll be coming back to central Wisconsin in the near future to do some book signings and make a series of appearances.
Yes, we are. My wife and I are coming up there. We'll be flying into Milwaukee on the 15th of July. We're really excited about it. We'll be coming into Stevens Point on the morning of the 16th. followed by the first book signing at the Plover Library on the 17th, which is Friday, from 3:30 in the afternoon till 8 o'clock. However, the library is furnishing us a key so we can lock up when we're finished because they anticipate a good crowd, and I hope that we do have a great crowd. I plan to address them as to, you know, take them through the journey of my life and the experiences and such, and then go on to the book signing. And we plan to have plenty on hand at the locations where people can buy them there and get them notarized and such.
Well, let's get into the book. Let's talk about the Posse Comitatus. These right-wing paramilitary groups are in the news right now, particularly in the wake of what happened in South Carolina, where the gunman was apparently influenced by white supremacist groups. In my introduction, I described the Posse Comitatus as a domestic terrorist organization, which is a language that you quote from the FBI. Is that description warranted? Are they or were they a terrorist organization?
Well, in reality, they were. If you read the entire story in the book, and that's taken from positive documentation, it all started, as far as we are concerned, and our participation, it started in 1981 with the shootout with federal agents at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, in which there were federal agents shot, and the leader at that time escaped to Arkansas. There was another shootout there. Two more U.S. Marshals were killed before he was taken down and martyred for the posse.
Tell us about this compound in Tigerton Dells, which is in Shawnee County, but near Portage County.
Yes, the compound was a fenced area, about 160 acres, fenced in chain link fence with a large gate at the front. It was chained and bordered by a large sign, "Wickstrom for Governor." It was about a 16 by 32 foot sign above the entrance. The folks lived in the compound. They had a schoolhouse and a gathering place for their meetings and such. They had a rather large rifle range in the rear of the compound, along with a bunker. We had to find a way to infiltrate somehow and study the situation in planning the removal of the posse. So
now you mentioned their spiritual leader, Jim Wickstrom, who is described in your book as a racist, anti-Semitic salesman. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, basically, he came into shine after the head of the posse was killed in the Arkansas situation following Wounded Knee, South Dakota shootout, and he led the posse. We were advised that he had been arrested for a tax evasion charge, and while he was held in the Shawnee County Jail, there were a procession of vehicles showing their solidarity each night circling the courthouse and the county jail. So he was then transferred for his own safety and for the safety of the public in Shawnee County to Milwaukee. He was held there, and that's where I started communicating with him.
Now, you indicate that this man who was a virulent white racist was put in a cell with six black men in Milwaukee County, which must have made quite an impression on him.
Yes, that was quite an experience for him. I tried to contact him, having the jailer pass him the telephone, and he absolutely refused to discuss anything with me. He told me to go right to hell. And it was only a day later that he called me. I had left the number so that if he wanted to open it to communication, we'd be happy to do that, because I was begged literally by Tony Earle, the governor at that time, because he's involved in the area mutual aid system. He reimburses the county, of course. And we wanted to avoid bloodshed if possible, and I thought that there was a way that we could negotiate them off of the compound, to have them go elsewhere. Well, when he returned the call, the story is in the book as to what he said, literally.
I don't think we can repeat it on the air.
No, right. So, and as far as the book is concerned, I have some real language in there. I changed nothing. What was said is what is printed. I didn't baffle the public with anything. I didn't use anything in place of the foul language.
There are no euphemisms. It's all right up front. Now this compound in Tigerton tells this was a heavily armed group. They didn't believe in the authority of the federal government. Is that right?
That's right. Absolutely. In fact, they had signs all over indicating that any federal agent stepping on a property will be shot. Other signs indicated that the survivors would be prosecuted and persecuted. So they were very, very active, and it all started with a traffic stop up near Oshkosh in which a pickup load to the top of the box was loaded with 223 ammunition, and there were literally millions of rounds. And that officer was instructed to deal with the traffic situation and have the person leave, because we didn't want to tip anybody off as to our plan and, you know, to be put in motion to remove the posse. So we knew that they were heavily armed based on pickup truck loads of ammunition being purchased for that purpose. And once we got to the compound, we had to find a way to apply some surveillance so we knew what was coming down. I had a couple of deputies that enjoyed fly fishing, and I instructed them to put on some fishing clothing and walk the Embarrass River, which is immediately adjacent to the compound.
Great trout stream.
What's that?
It's a great trout stream.
Yes, it is. And they were confronted by a rifleman telling them that, you know, they have no business being there, and they said they did, that they entered at the road, and they had every right to be there. And he told them that, you know, you're coming by the rifle range, and there you could get hit by a stray bullet. So, you know, it was very gutsy on their part to simply continue, and brought back information that was very valuable to us.
Now you write that Jim Wickstrom, this spiritual leader, there was a sign, Wickstrom for governor. He was heavily influenced by the Christian Identity Movement and a former Methodist minister named Wesley Smith. Can you talk about for just a little bit about the way these people think and view the world, and particularly where they come up with their white supremacist beliefs?
Well, first off, you know, their explanation for their existence, their legal existence, is that they are afforded the opportunity by the Constitution to create a militia and to protect themselves, and they strongly believed that any federal agent or federal law had no jurisdiction over them. In fact, they listed Tigerton Dells as a Tigerton Dells township, and Jim Wickstrom and Manischewski were going to be the leadership within. They really did believe, you know, from my estimation, that the Constitution allowed them to do that, and that they didn't have to be forced to pay federal taxes. They didn't have to abide by local rules and such, that they were a sovereign nation, if you would. And that's the way it came about.
And they had this twisted view of religion. You write that they believed that only the white race was created in the form of God.
Yep.
African and Asian races were subhuman mud people.
Yes.
Eve was seduced by a serpent pretending to be a white man who gave birth to Cain, who became the first Jew, who they described as all Jews as a spawn of Satan. So it was really some very you know, twisted stuff in
yes.
terms of their ideology.
Yes, very much like a cult, you know. The thing was that they preyed on individuals that were facing catastrophe. For an example, a farmer facing foreclosure by the banks and such, you know, they considered the banks their enemy, that was a serpent in itself. They would approach that farmer to offer assistance and a way out of the situation, and they would actually form lines of riflemen along his property and dare anybody to come take it. So, you know, it was, they reached people in the public, were that were at their very lowest possible position in life. You know, they're about to lose things. So along comes, the man on the white horse to save the day. And that's how they got a great deal of their membership. And some people really started to believe that this is their right and they can follow.
Tell us a little bit about Don Minaszewski, the guy that brandished that Colt 45 in front of you when you had the one-on-one meeting with the posse. And he's a guy who also invited Jim Wickstrom back to Wisconsin.
Yes. He owned the property there along with the Tigerton Dells Tavern and Dance Hall. And, it was basically his idea to form a township, and he brought Wickstrom in to lead the charge, if you will. That's how it came about. He was a very, very adamant individual in terms of what their rights are, and, they were very antagonistic when it came to local restaurants and such. They'd walk in with their fatigue uniforms and sit and simply stare at people. So it was not good for business or the climate in the community as well with those people around and the way they conducted themselves.
Now, you were the Portage County Sheriff, and this compound was in Shawano County. How did you end up being the lead man in the effort to shut them down?
Well, first of all, I think, looking out over the broad spectrum, I'm giving far too much credit for having removed the posse. I mean, the sheriff in Shawano County did an extraordinary job, as well as the sheriffs in our region, in supplying what we needed. The position I had was to coordinate an effort in order to comply with the system set up previous to my getting there with the governor, in which National Guard would not be called out on domestic and civil situations, that we were in the best position to deal with that. And since the sheriff and the governor are the only two people mentioned in the Wisconsin Constitution, I felt that who better to negotiate with them and such, knowing that this is what they preach, that they are part of the Constitution and it's their right. So, blowing away the sheriff would do them absolutely no good in terms of what they've preached versus what they practice. So I felt that we had inroads there. I know that, using state troopers, we use them in traffic control, city police and such, because they are appointed officers, and I feared for their safety and their lives.
So here it is, the night of May 29th, a driving rainstorm, and you, as the sheriff of Portage County, you walk into that compound in Tigerton Dells by yourself to negotiate with Manischewski in Wickstrom's home.
Yes, but we were careful to. First of all, this occurred following a county board meeting I had with the Portage County Board of Supervisors, so it put it into late night, and that's how we set up the meeting. So discussing it with Sheriff Knope in Shawano County, he indicated that it was somewhat radical on my part to take that chance in terms of my safety. So he posted squad cars with shotguns with buckshot near the entrance. We agreed on a 45-minute span of time during which I'm to deal with the posse and negotiate. And if I was not out at the end of 45 minutes, they would come in and get me, now, knowing that I'm in trouble.
And once again, Manischewski brandished that 45. He said, quote, "You will walk knee-deep in blood." And another posse member warned you that the people in the compound were fully trained warriors. How did you respond to that?
Well, basically, what they're telling me or asking me is whether or not I felt that I had the firepower to take on a situation like this. And, my response was, move you will. You know, you're going to be removed. You know, I would love to avoid a confrontation, bloodshed. You got women and children in this compound with you. You know, you're putting them in danger. You know, so it would be very, very simple to walk out of the situation, go back to the township and abide by the ordinances, the zoning laws, and we'll all do just fine. But their position was very adamant that, you know, we're going to, you know, if we thought that Wounded Knee South Dakota was a big deal, you walk in here, you'll find out, you know. So,
how did you end up shutting them down? And I'm talking about you in the plural sense, you and all of the other officers that worked with you, without a single shot being fired.
Well, first of all, like I said, we did the initial surveillance. We worked with the FBI because they were watching the group very closely. And meeting with the governor in terms of the mutual aid pact and his support, and he was very, very good about, you know, going along with our plan. He wanted to see what that plan was. We showed it to him, shared it with him, and Sheriff Canope and I assured him that we would do everything possible to avoid bloody confrontation. So the plan went on, and we shared that information with the sheriffs in our region on a QT and instructed them not to pass on information to deputies because, you know, conversation can lead to leaks.
And they were actually planning on having a meeting at that compound, right?
That's,
because
that's
you tipped
that's
them
correct.
Off. So there were posse members coming from all over the country, and who knows what would have happened if that had taken place.
Actually, the meeting did occur. Okay, I wasn't quite explicit enough. And that's when I got the response from the FBI. They did some aerial surveillance, getting pictures of license numbers on automobiles and so on, knowing that these people were coming to this meeting on a Sunday, and it was a couple of weeks before we actually made our move to the compound, and it was a sizable group. So they felt that the information leaked out, and the purpose of the meeting was to prepare for our attempt to ouster the group.
So let's go to the morning right now when you actually got the compound shut down. It's about 5 a.m. You're at the gates of the compound. Give me a blow-by-blow. Tell me exactly what happened that morning.
Okay, all right. Well, actually, let's go back a few hours. We all agreed to meet at the high school auditorium at 2 o'clock in the morning, which we did. And we went over the final details of the plan and, you know, made sure that every base was covered. Then we shuttled the manpower to the compound with school buses to avoid, you know, showing, you know, 50 or 75 squad cars, okay? So when we got to the compound gate, this was already prearranged, and Sheriff Knope took care of the communication cuts. So
you cut phone service and electricity to the compound,
yes,
right?
Yes, everything was cut off at the gate.
And there were no cell phones back then, so they had no way of communicating with the outside world.
Right, right. And that was our biggest fear, is that they could call in backups, you know, and we'd be boxed into a situation if there were riflemen and such coming in from the outside. So the chain on the gate was cut, and the officers, the deputies, proceeded. And the only people we used within the compound were sheriffs and deputies. Again, I can't stress enough the importance to abide by and stay within the Constitution, hoping that they will respect that. So one deputy from Shawnee County had the paperwork in his hand, the eviction from the township, signed by a judge, and knocked on the door, and this all took place after 4:30 in the morning. So we had 6- and 7-man teams that accompanied the single deputy to each door. So the deputy from Shawnee County knocked on the door, and the first person to answer the door was served, and the SRT, as we call them, Special Response Units teams, were there to protect the deputy and to take control of the situation. The very first house that was approached by a team, in fact, a couple of my deputies from Portage County were on that team, the gentleman, rather than coming to a door, there was a screened area in front of the house, and he peered through the screen with his nose up against it, and we knew that he was one of the radical membership there. And a pretty good-sized deputy from Portage County reached through the screen, grabbed him by the neck, and pulled him outside through the screen wall, if you will.
How did you take care of the guard dogs?
Well, this all happened simultaneously. We had a couple of people with tranquilizers that were going to take the dogs down if necessary, because they were large German shepherds. But when the team hit the first house and pulled the man outside and cuffed him, the rest of the team stormed into the house. They opened the refrigerator because there was a dog growling behind him, coming at him, and he found a T-bone laying on a plate in the refrigerator, and he tossed it to the dog, and the dog thanked him, and he then pulled some hot dogs and continued to feed the dog, and the additional two guard dogs came up, and they were fed, and they followed the deputies around like they were their best friend.
So you took them by surprise, you got them out of there, and then you actually physically removed the buildings.
Yes. First of all, this was a super master plan in terms of Sheriff Knoop and the work that he did in aligning everything, and everything was done to the letter. The first trucks to come in were reefers, you know, the refrigerated vans. They would park in front of the house. One deputy stood with a recording device in his hand. The others emptied the foodstuffs into boxes and loaded them into the trucks. Because we weren't there to destroy their property, we still had to protect what they had. So when that was done, the next truck that pulled up was a furniture moving truck, and they loaded the furniture, and furniture was all labeled by voice as it came out of the house and was loaded into the trailers, so the houses were clean. That was followed by two moving companies that were set up to move the houses. These were all double-wide modular homes, like double-wide mobile homes, only in Wisconsin they're called prefabs. One man got up on the roof and with a chainsaw, and he split it at the seam, and the moving company, jacked the two halves of the house up and slid it onto beams and onto trailers, pulled it to a 20-acre field that the township gave us to use across the road from there, and the trailer halves, or the mobile home halves, were parked there and shrink-wrapped to protect them as well, because, you know, we weren't there to destroy the property. They were still entitled to what they owned.
And so, what does that compound look like right now?
It looks very much like a golf course.
No sign of the posse comitatus.
No.
And Dan Hintz, how do you react to the idea that these right-wing white supremacist paramilitary groups are still around? Jerry on Facebook, sends us a message that the Southern Poverty Law Center is still very much concerned about these groups.
Oh, yes. And according to the FBI, there is a group of 4,000. I'm not going to state location or anything, but they are keeping track of the individuals as to where they are and what they're up to. And it's a group that has to be watched very closely. They're not breaking laws, per se, in preparation for this. You know, everybody has a right to bear arms. And by the way, when we hit the compound and went into the residence, this is the first house where the man was pulled through the screen. It had a large screen porch with a concrete floor. And there were seven rifles, including two on bipods that were facing the exterior. The two on bipods had belts of ammunition attached to them, so he was darn ready to take on anything. So I commended the deputy, and I do till this day, that he took the action he did to pull that man through the screen, because the blood would have would have flown. no question had that man had the access to that ammunition.
Dan Hintz, we're way over for a break. It's been just an incredible story. We're talking to Dan Hintz, the former Portage County Sheriff, who's got a new book out about his run-in with the Posse Comitatus and other events in his life in law enforcement in pursuit of justice. I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back with more after this.
When I was arrested, I was dressed in black. They put me on a train and they took me back. Had no friend for to go my bail. They slapped my dirty carcass in that county jail. Early next morning, about a half past nine, I spied a sheriff coming down the line. Up then he coughed as he cleared his throat. He said, "Come on, you dirty hack, into that district court."
Thank you to the business sponsors who help support WPR programs. Businesses like Madison Gas and Electric, Al Johnson Swedish Restaurant, and Rittenhouse play a huge role in the success of WPR. For more information, go to wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy of Stevens Point, designing and installing solar systems, highly efficient wood boiler systems, and providing deep energy retrofits to buildings. Northwind's project portfolio is available at northwindre.com.
And the Ranger's aim was deadly with the big iron on his hip, big iron on his hip. It was over in a moment and the folks had gathered round. There before them lay the body of the outlaw on the ground. Oh, he might have went on living, but he made one fatal slip when he tried to match the Ranger with the big iron on his hip. Big iron on his hip.
I'm Glenn Mobrick, our guest today on Route 51, former Portage County Sheriff Dan Hintz, author of the new book In Pursuit of Justice, Memoirs of a Small Town Sheriff, co-authored by John Spiller, and you can find that on Amazon.com. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-780-9742. Dan, let's move to another incident that you talk about, an event really. We're talking specifically about the Iola Rock Festival, which took place in the summer of 1970. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, it was a program set up to entertain young people out in the country. The promoter rented a farm with some outbuildings, and it turned out to be quite a group, bigger than we ever expected, certainly. I was the deputy sheriff at that time, and we did set up checkpoints and such to make sure that we could control weapon influence and, you know, heavy drug use and that sort of thing. So, you know, the people paid to get through the gate, and, you know, after the first day, I mean, this thing was really, really getting out of hand. It was wall-to-wall people. I don't know
50,000 how many 50,000 people was one estimate that I saw.
What's that?
50,000 people was one estimate I saw for
yes,
that event.
Yes. Yes, it was really, really big. I mean, there were tents set up with, you know, there were little signs on paper plates, you know, that grass was available there, LSD, gosh, you name it. And we were in a situation where we had hardly enough manpower to handle the traffic situation coming in and to respond to any emergencies that might occur. Much less enforce drug laws and over drinking and such.
So there were people just smoking pot and dropping acid and doing cocaine, and you couldn't do anything about it.
No, we were. I mean, our hands were tied. You know, we expected you know 4,000 or 5,000 people possibly, but oh my gosh, the lines of traffic were just phenomenal. And I had one situation where a little VW bus pulled up with a dead deer on top. And I asked the individual where he got the deer, and he said he found it on the roadside. It was hit by a car, apparently. And I asked him what he intended to do with it. And he said, "We're going to eat it this weekend." You know, so it was quite an experience.
Makeshift hospital tent overwhelmed by 3,500 medical emergencies. That's one of the things you write in your book.
Yes, yes. It was just incredible. You know, people that were, you know, really, really sick, people that got hurt, you know, they tripped and it dislocated an ankle, gosh, you name it. But things started to get out of hand on the third day, which was on Sunday, when a motorcycle group came in. I believe it was from the Milwaukee area.
Well, that's just like in Altamont, which was the subject of the Rolling Stones movie Gimme Shelter, where you had the Hell's Angels basically, turning this outdoor concert into a maelstrom of violence.
Yes, it was. In fact, the complaints came forward that the cyclists would come in, and there was a big water tank, as an example, of a tanker truck that supplied the drinking water. And the cyclist pulled the hatch open on top and dove into it, took baths in the drinking water, and then urinated in water to avoid the possibility of people being able to get a drink of water. And there were reports of attacks, robberies, rapes in the tents, where these guys were very forceful against a music-listening hippie group, if you will.
And we understand that a security guard was injured while the Amboy Dukes with Ted Nugent was playing.
Yes, yes. That happened during the same time period. And the hippie group, if you will, got their heads together and decided they're going to drive these people out, and they started to chase them. And there were thousands, literally, with sticks and fence posts and pieces of wire, you name it. And the cyclists hop on their bikes and, to escape, with one person facing forward, the other backward. The person in the back was shooting back at the crowd, and there were, I believe, three people hit. Nobody was killed in the situation, but eventually they were overtaken. They ran on foot to a flatbed truck that they tried escaping in, while the people at the event stacked the motorcycles on a pile and torched them. They lit them up. So the group on the flatbed truck takes off, down the road, and it was a very hilly road. And we gave chase with three squad cars. And we ended up costing Portage County a great deal in body damage, because when the front squad got to the top of the hill, they saw the truck parked at the bottom of the hill with the people laying across the road, some kneeling with sawed-off shotguns and such, waiting for us. So when he locked the brakes, my car inadvertently kissed the back of his car. And then the squad car following me, I happened to glance up in the rear view. I saw him talking on the radio, looking to the right, and he kind of stacked us up, you know.
So it sounds like a scene from the...
It was quite embarrassing at that point. But we...
It sounds like a scene from the Blues Brothers, Dan.
Yeah, really. And the deputy riding with me, as a matter of fact, dislocated his wrist in the process because he was trying to unlock the shotgun. We had him mounted in a locked position, standing up inside the squad car.
So here you've got three squad cars crashing into each other. You've got a flatbed truck blocking the road. You've got bikers armed with shotguns, and a crowd of hippies running behind you, trying to catch up with the bikers.
Yeah, it was quite a fiasco. But we were fortunate in that we lined up across the road, and they were given orders. The sheriff at that time, Nick Check, in fact, was in a helicopter by this time, and above the truck that was parked, and giving them orders over a bullhorn to surrender or they're going to get hurt. So eventually they did. So they were all handcuffed, and we used the bus to bus them to the county jail where they were incarcerated. And most of them appeared in court the following Monday.
What happened to the promoter who organized this thing?
He kind of disappeared. He became part of the cloud. He was nowhere to be found. He left. We know he left the state for parts unknown.
And you write that after that happened, 65 of the state's 72 counties in 1971 adopted restrictions on mass gatherings. So something like the Iola Rock Festival could never happen again anywhere in Wisconsin.
That's correct. That's correct. All based on the experience that we had in Portage County.
Now, you used to also cut down marijuana growing around Portage County, and then you'd hold public burns for the reporters. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I had heard prior to me running for the office of sheriff, there was a concern as to confiscated property, what's happening to it, what happened to all these drugs, that sort of thing, and I wasn't going to let that happen. We found groves based on information we got from the public, and we had good communication with the people in Portage County. And they would point out where the groves were growing, so you know, we would stake it out, and if we had no activity around it, after a certain period of time, we went in with machetes, and we had an old deuce and a half, a military deuce and a half, that we'd load them on, and we would haul them to the annex, and I used to get complaints from deputies as to how potent the smell was until they could somewhat dry on pallets. Then I invited the county board to come out to witness the situation when we destroy that property. So we did it visibly, and you know, there was no question as to what we did with the drugs that we confiscated.
Well, here it is, 2015, and marijuana is not only still with us, it's legal now for recreational use in Colorado, Washington State, and Oregon, and more areas are treating it like an unimportant offense. As somebody who had to cut down these marijuana fields, how do you react to that, and do you think it should be legal in Wisconsin or anywhere else?
Well, first of all, no, I don't think it should be legal. Marijuana is such that, in fact, we voiced our opinions back then, that it should not be handled as a criminal offense, that it should be decriminalized, not legalized, to be handled like drinking beer or whiskey and operating an automobile, or drinking beer and whiskey and becoming disorderly in public, you know. So we felt that it was better served to be handled as a misdemeanor, therefore receiving a citation for their violations, the same as any other, because it makes no difference whether a person is under the influence of alcohol or under the influence of marijuana when they're operating an automobile. You know, they're a hazard on the highway, and it should be dealt in such fashion, the same as any other.
And you've seen a lot of crime scenes and accident scenes where alcohol and drugs played a factor.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And it was just devastating, you know. Particularly, you know, we felt very responsible in that we need to take some action of some sort, you know, and that's the way you do things in law enforcement. You concentrate on historical events. You know, things that happened last week. What do we do about it? You know, we got a strip out on Highway 66 where these guys come out of bars and they're placing $20 bets as to who can go the fastest. Well, we need to have a squad car out there and stop it. You know.
Got it. Dan Hintz, who is a former Portage County Sheriff, author of In Pursuit of Justice. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We'll be back with more after this.
You punk!
Dear kindly Sergeant Krupke, you gotta understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good.
There is good. There is good. There is untapped good. Like inside, the worst of us is good.
Thank you to the businesses who help support WPR programs, including Alvarado Real Estate Group, Festival Choir of Madison, and Northern Sky Theater. Play a role in the success of WPR. Become a business sponsor. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy of Stevens Point, designing and installing solar systems, highly efficient wood boiler systems, and providing deep energy retrofits to buildings. Northwind's project portfolio is available at northwindre.com.
I got a star on my car and one on my chest, a gun on my hip and the right to arrest. I'm the guy who's a boss on this highway, so watch out what you're doing when you're driving my way. If you break the law, you'll hear from me. I know I'm a working for the state. I'm the highway patrol.
And Junior Brown is taking us into the last segment on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with former Portage County Sheriff Dan Hintz, who has a new book out called In Pursuit of Justice. And, boy, this hour has gone very, very quickly, Dan. I want to touch on one thing that you bring up. You were kind of a tough guy as a sheriff's deputy, a police chief and sheriff. You write that you never backed away from a fight. You talked about a barroom brawl in which you slammed an assailant's face into a pay telephone. You pulled a guy over for speeding. He gave you some lip, challenged you to a fight. Then you met him when you were off duty at a local tavern and dragged him out into the parking lot. Is this any way for a police officer to act?
Well, I guess the human part of it comes into play. It was a situation where, you know, I have a reputation to defend, and that is, you know, an officer needs to be strong. He needs to be brave. You know, I never pushed the situation to make it appear as though I'm operating outside the law. But I never backed down. I didn't feel that was my place. In terms of the guy getting his face slammed into a telephone, that was purely an accident, which followed a pool cue that he broke over his knee, and he swung it to hit a man in the head, and I caught it in the air. And by gosh, I'll tell you, it burns when you catch a full swing in your hand. I grabbed him by the back of the neck, and I swung him away from the situation and to a wall. And it just so happened that there was a payphone on the wall, and he hit that. He kissed the phone on his way across.
You indicate that the people in the tavern applauded when you did that.
Yes, because, you know, it was a person that that loved to mix it up. He was a person that didn't concern himself with hurting somebody in bar fights and such, you know.
Well,
he was
Dan,
feared by many.
Dan, you also write, and this is a quote from your book, it's a fact that some people hate law enforcement officers. Why do they hate? Because some law officers are jerks. They're crude, ignorant, pompous, donut-consumed egomaniacs who wear the badge as a justification to harass the public rather than protect it.
Yes. Well, that's the belief that the individual that hates law enforcement paints for himself, you know. A donut-eating, individual, that's a joke. I mean, law enforcement officers keep themselves in condition. You know, how many overweight or underweight or undernourished officers have you seen, particularly in Portage County?
But Dan, there is a perception right now that sometimes the cops just go too far. We have all of these highly publicized incidents of police officers shooting unarmed black men. Can you comment on that? And I'm sorry, but you've only got about a minute to do it because we're running out of time. And what law enforcement departments can do to make sure that their officers meet high professional standards?
Sure, I'll be happy to do that if you give me a couple of minutes after the fact to state some of the signing dates with the Historical Society and such.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in watching the situation in Missouri as an example, you know, that was driven to a point where it becomes an us-against-them syndrome. You know, when you start mounting machine guns on personnel carriers and such and draw lines in the sand with riflemen with the rifles facing the people that are picketing, you've pushed it beyond. I think the situation where the man was shot in the back running away, well, that's a rogue cop, and that's one that has to be dealt with. That's no different than you yourself, Glenn, shooting your secretary because she decided to quit her job and she's running out the door.
Well, I don't have a secretary, but
okay.
Dan Hintz, give us those dates again real quick because we are completely out of time.
We'll be up there on Friday, the 17th of July. We'll be signing books and addressing the groups at the Plover Library from 3:30 to 8 o'clock or longer if it takes. We will be meeting with the Historical Society, where the public is invited, on Saturday, the following day, which is the 18th. We'll be meeting at the Temple in Stevens Point. Monday night, we'll be at the Stevens Point Library from 4 o'clock to 7:30. And also, we have stops in Galloway, Shantytown, and we finalize in Rosholt at the library on Friday the 24th.
Okay, Dan, we're out of time. Former Portage County Sheriff Dan Hintz, thank you so much for being with us. The book is called In Pursuit of Justice, Memoirs of a Small Town Sheriff. It is available on Amazon.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks so much for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Until next week, we're heading out of town.